Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 1151 of the Juice Box Podcast. Today, I'm going to expand the Grand Round series. It's not Jenny and I today. Today, it's Dr. John Oden and myself talking about type 1 diabetes care. Up until now, it's been Jenny and I talking to doctors about what we think people with type 1 diabetes need. Today, we're going to hear from one. Please don't forget that nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan or becoming bold with insulin. How would you like to help with type 1 diabetes research from wherever you are right now in fewer than 10 minutes? Go to t1dexchange.org/juicebox and complete the survey. That's it. You need to be a U.S. resident who has type 1 diabetes or is the caregiver of someone with type 1. And they're very interested in hearing from caregivers of boys, boys of color, men of color. But everyone is welcome if you're a U.S. resident, you have type 1, or you're the caregiver of someone who is. t1dexchange.org/juicebox. You'll be helping. It won't take much time. Please consider it. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the Eversense CGM. And sure, all CGM systems use transcutaneous sensors that are inserted into the skin and last 7 to 14 days. But the Eversense sensor is inserted completely under the skin, lasting 6 months. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the Contour Next Gen Blood Glucose Meter. Learn more and get started today at contournext.com/juicebox. This show is sponsored today by the glucagon that my daughter carries, Gvoke HypoPen. Find out more at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox.
Hello, I'm John Oden. I am a pediatric endocrinologist in Arkansas. I work mainly at a Little Rock, but go into the Northwest every once in a while.
John, why am I talking to you today from where are you at?
I am currently in a town called Springdale, which is the house of one of our newest pediatric hospitals for Arkansas Children's. It's Arkansas Children's Northwest. I think our discussion today was born from a couple of my diabetes education people. Roxana Hutchcroft recommended I reach out to you because, well, I'm an endocrinologist. Your podcast is highlights diabetes quite a bit, which I applaud. I'm an advocate for people with diabetes, and I'm a person who has had diabetes for the past 42 years.
Oh, no kidding. John, how old are you?
I am 53 years old.
53? So you diagnosed when you're 9? Is that right?
11.
11. Oh, damn. You know, I had 9 or 11 in my head as a choice, and I don't know why I went with 9. I also don't know why my brain can't figure that out, but that's neither here nor there.
That's okay, because I keep thinking I was diagnosed when I was 10. I keep thinking that for some reason, but I was diagnosed in September of 81. September of 82.
So John, you're diagnosed, what are you taking, regular MPH?
Yeah, 2 shots a day, regular MPH, very strict meals, very strict times, exchange diet, if you will. You had to, one slice of bread is a starch, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Now, is there, in hindsight, other autoimmune in your family?
There is. My mother suffers from thyroid, as does my sister, hypothyroidism. So there is. Mm-hmm.
Nothing beyond that, though. Celiac?
No, not celiac. But I mean, my mother and my sister, they weren't born in a time where celiac was a focus. So I can't remember if my doctors ever screened us, and I certainly don't know if their endocrinologist screened them. So it's very possible.
Can I ask you a strange one that you might not connect, but I ask about because I've been making the podcast for so long and I hear so many people's answers? How about depression, anxiety, or bipolar specifically?
You mean for me personally or family?
Like family member, even like either side going back anywhere.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was a touch of depression and anxiety in all of us, mm-hmm. family members, meaning I don't mean to say that in a bad way. They certainly weren't, dark room depressed. You know, they But, you know, every once in a while, you could probably see the glimmer of some anxiety in my sister and myself. Sure.
Okay. I over the years, and I'm now well over 1,100 episodes, the amount of people who will say I have a bipolar aunt or uncle is kind of overwhelming. When you talk about, inflammation and, you know, kind of things that we're still learning, obviously, I think our medical understanding of a lot of things is very young still. So anyway, I just like to ask. Okay, so you're 11 years old. Were you doing two a day? You're eating very specifically. Your parents help a lot, or did you get into a rhythm and it was just on you?
To be honest, it was always on me. And that was not my parents' choice. It was mine. From day one, when I was admitted, we were in Houston. So I went to UTMB in Galveston. And from day one, nurse walked in, said, "Hey, you're going to start insulin injections." I remember it very clearly. She walked in with this needle that was, 6 inches long, not really. But they were Terumo or BD, big. They were pretty long needles. I took it from her hand. I said, "I'm going to do this." And ever since then, I can honestly say a nurse has, other than vaccinations, has never given me a shot.
Do you think you wanted to do it, or did you not want someone else to do it?
Oh, that's a great question. Wasn't afraid of it. So I guess, I just felt it was on me to take care of it.
Okay.
And in my practice, you see kids like that and they're very independent, predicts, pretty good control. Although, in my instance, it was a lot of obsessive compulsive. I want to be controlling things, controlling blood sugar. That's part of the reason why my control is so quote unquote good. Partly why I have as many lows as I do. I don't like to be high. And so part of that is, that obsessive compulsive nature of, I want my blood sugar to be X and I'm going to fight to make it X. And I want to be the only person that puts a needle in my skin. And that's what's going to happen.
Is that focus, that attitude prevalent through your whole life? Or is that just how you treat diabetes? Or no. Can I not have the remote control if we're watching television or something like that? If you take insulin or sulfonylureas, you are at risk for your blood sugar going too low. You need a safety net when it matters most. Be ready with Gvoke HypoPen. My daughter carries Gvoke HypoPen everywhere she goes because it's a ready-to-use rescue pen for treating very low blood sugar in people with diabetes ages 2 and above that I trust. Low blood sugar emergencies can happen unexpectedly, and they demand quick action. Luckily, Gvoke HypoPen can be administered in 2 simple steps, even by yourself in certain situations. Show those around you where you store Gvoke HypoPen and how to use it. They need to know how to use Gvoke HypoPen before an emergency situation happens. Learn more about why Gvoke HypoPen is in Arden's Diabetes Toolkit at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. Gvoke shouldn't be used if you have a tumor in the gland on the top of your kidneys called a pheochromocytoma, or if you have a tumor in your pancreas called an insulinoma. Visit gvokeglucagon.com/risk for safety information. The Contour Next Gen Blood Glucose Meter is the meter that we use here. Arden has one with her at all times. I have one downstairs in the kitchen, just in case I want to check my blood sugar, and Arden has them at school. They're everywhere that she is. ContourNext.com/juicebox. Test strips and the meters themselves may be less expensive for you in cash out of your pocket than you're paying currently through your insurance for another meter. You can find out about that and much more at my link, ContourNext.com/juicebox. Contour makes a number of fantastic and accurate meters, and their second chance test strips are absolutely my favorite part. What does that mean? If you go to get some blood and maybe you touch it and, stumble with your hand and like slip off and go back, it doesn't impact the quality or accuracy of the test. So you can hit the blood, not get enough, come back, get the rest without impacting the accuracy of the test. That's right. You can touch the blood, come back and get the rest, and you're going to get an absolutely accurate test. I think that's important because we all stumble and fumble at times. That's not a good reason to have to waste a test strip. And with the Contour Next Gen, you won't have to. ContourNext.com/juicebox. You're going to get a great reading without having to be perfect?
Oh, yeah. I am obsessive compulsive about certain things. My wife will tell you I have this compulsive nature to buy vintage audio and repair it. And she just gets sick and tired of seeing old tape players in our garage. So there are pieces in my life that I think you can see that. But to the most extent, I feel that it's pretty mild. I'm a pretty open person and willing to hear others' thoughts on how things go.
Are you using that word clinically or just kind of colloquially?
Obsessive compulsive?
Yeah.
I would say mostly colloquially. I think it's somewhat clinical, but over the years I've learned to kind of manage it so that it doesn't really frustrate my family. And
I hear you.
I am the kind of guy that gets up, you know, right before we go to bed and checks the doors 3 or 4 times to make sure that they're locked, even though I know I've checked them 100 times.
Oh, maybe it is clinical, John. I'm not a doctor. Yeah. But
not medically managed, I guess, is what I mean.
It's fantastic. So you grow up this way. How long does the exchange diet idea go through your life? Like, when did they, because if you're an 81, when did they give you, I'm trying to guess, what'd you get, like, basal insulin in like 88, around then?
I never started Lantus.
No?
No, I always was on NPH. I started Humalog in the early 90s.
Okay.
Be honest with you, if my recollection is correct, and I was one of these people that, you know, I kept my diabetes in pretty good control, and we had to drive 45 minutes to an hour, my parents and I, to UTMB I don't think it was every 3 months, but it could have been. Up until I graduated high school, and then I started seeing adult. And by that time, I had learned how much insulin to give myself based on carbohydrate volume. So I was already doing kind of a meal ratio before doctors or dietitians had talked to me about it.
Yeah, that's excellent. So you saw it enough in your own life. You're like, I'm going to make an adjustment here on my own.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. What was the measurement of success? Like you said, you were in good control, but how did they tell you where you were? Because you didn't have a meter, right, for a while, I would imagine, at home.
Oh, we used those old AccuCheck meters. Using those in the mid 80s, and you know, you had to have a big dollop of blood, and you know, it gave you a range of like 80 to 120 or like a roundabout number, you know. So it wasn't, you know, hugely accurate. It took 5 minutes to get anything. You had to wash it off with sterile saline, that kind of stuff. It was, you know, very technical. But shortly thereafter, we started seeing meters kind of pop up.
Okay.
Measure of success was always kind of A1C. How many low blood sugars did you have? Were you ever in the hospital? And there was a question on the questionnaire at UTMB that always struck my parents. And it was, does he or she use his or her diabetes to get out of, you know, chores or responsibilities?
Hmm. So A1C... amount of lows. Have you been in DKA? Do you use this as an excuse?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. And how were your lows?
Manageable. I think, you know, back then when we were only kind of checking blood sugars with finger poke and chemiluminescent strips, you know, that gave you a range, or the meters that gave you a range or a roundabout number. I think I probably had a couple of lows a week.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, you and I know that was probably not very accurate. You know, I probably was experiencing lows
more
once or twice a day.
So, John, tell me what you call low. Under what?
Less than 70.
Under 70. Where do you feel it? Like, where do you feel like you're not yourself?
Well, with a rapid drop, I can certainly feel it. So when my CGM shows me with an arrow down or two arrows down, and I'm going from like, I'm going to be very conservative, you know, 200 to... you know, to 90 pretty quickly, I'll feel it. You feel a little wobbly, you feel a little, you know, shaky, sweaty.
Mm.
But if it's a slow decline, I would say I'd probably start feeling it less than 60.
60. Where can you not help yourself anymore? Do you know?
Oh, goodness. I've been in the teens and still been able to take care of myself. But then I've had some pretty significant drops overnight that my wife had to help me. And when we measured, it was in the 40s.
Okay. Does that happen to you now as much that there's the technology's better? Like, does that still happen?
Oh, no.
No.
No. Not, it hasn't happened in years.
Yeah.
My A1Cs have been in the lower sixes, upper fives for a while. So,
right. Yeah.
I would say that it's very, very rare.
Mm-hmm. No, it's just that back then, right, there wasn't as much precision. You didn't have any kind of, the monitoring was, you know,
right.
Catch as catch can.
But I never had a severe low. I will tell you, I'll be honest. I never had a severe low while I was living with my parents, never.
Okay.
In fact, one time when I did have a low that required glucagon that my wife had to give me, my mom was actually staying with us. And she did not know how to use the glucagon.
How about that? Years later.
Yeah, years later. And we found that the times that I had severe lows were always associated with like yard work or moving. So if it was hot outside and I was really active and got dehydrated, that tend to predict a significant low. And so, you know, my wife and I are always like, okay, so you chop down a tree today or whatever.
And you're going to go, you're getting low.
We're going to go low tonight. So tonight you're going to eat a lot.
It's interesting. Is it how, at what age did that one low you're talking about where your mom was visiting? Were you like in your early 20s? Had you just gotten married or something? Or
I was in my fellowship. So I'm guessing I was in my late 20s.
Okay. And that's interesting. And what was your management like back then for that?
I was on a pump. So I started pumps around the same time. If memory serves, I started my pump when my daughter was one and she's 23 now. So it was around the same time.
Yeah. Okay. Do you use an algorithm now?
I'm on the OP5.
Okay.
I used to use Tandem, but I switched the OP5 because I can put it in different places on my torso and my arms.
You like the form factor of the Omnipod?
I do.
Yeah. And you, before that, you used Control IQ or just the Tandem? Basal IQ.
I use Control IQ. Yeah.
Okay.
I use Basal IQ for a brief period of time. Then I switched to Control IQ. I find both platforms are phenomenal.
Yeah, I agree. Also, it's interesting how quickly they went from Basal IQ to Control IQ. They almost like released that first thing. Like, look what we got like approved. And then before I feel like they didn't expect the next one to come that quickly because it was really quickly after that.
Yeah, it was.
But the tubing and the form factor meant enough to you to move on from something you enjoyed?
The tubing, not so much. You get used to the tubing. I think it was the fact that the pump sites for me, I couldn't put them on my legs because I'm a runner. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't discipline myself enough to carefully remove my shirt so I don't rip my pump site off of my arm. I tried it a couple of times. So I developed a pretty significant amount of lipohypertrophy around the front of my torso. So I was like, hey, it's time for a change.
Yeah,
so
you were overusing your only site that you were willing to use. Yeah. I don't understand when people say I'm a runner, but that's a different podcast. So you go out and run somewhere on purpose and nothing's chasing you.
No, nothing's chasing me. No, no, but I can tell you that I am an amateur runner. I'm not a person that runs every day, but I am training to do the half marathon this year in Little Rock, which is
Are all five of your toes pointing forward still?
Oh, they are. Yeah, but I lost last time I did it. I lost the big toenails, which was a little gross for my kids.
Yeah, you know? Hey. That's gross for me, John. I don't know you, and I can't say it. So it's fantastic. When in your life do you say I'm going to? Do you think you would have been a doctor with or without diabetes? This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Eversense. And Eversense is the implantable CGM that lasts 6 months. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. Have you ever been running out the door and knocked your CGM off? Or had somewhere to be and realized that your adhesive was about to fall off? That won't happen with Eversense. Eversense won't get sweaty and slide off. It won't bang into a door jam. And it lasts 6 months. Not just a couple days or a week. The Eversense CGM has a silicon-based adhesive for its transmitter, which you change every day. So it's not one of those super sticky things that's designed to stay on you forever and ever, even though we know they don't work sometimes. But that's not the point. Because it's not that kind of adhesive, you shouldn't see any skin irritations. So if you've had skin irritations with other products, maybe you should try Eversense. Unique, implantable, and accurate. So if you're tired of dealing with things falling off or being too sticky or not sticky enough or not staying on for the life of the sensor, you probably want to check out Eversense. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. Links in the show notes. Links at juiceboxpodcast.com.
Probably not. I will be honest. Before I developed diabetes, I'm going to take a step back. My family comes from on my mom's side, a lot of people in the Navy, and I have a lot of respect for our military this country. Right? I had planned to become a naval aviator. I wanted to fly F-14s back in the day. But then after diagnosis, my uncle and I had a conversation about the possibility of a person with diabetes joining the Navy in any way, shape, or form. And he just told me very, very honestly and frankly that no, that wouldn't be possible. And it just broke my heart. So thinking back on the days when I was, you know, with Dr. Travis and Dr. Brohard at UTMB, which is phenomenal group, great doctors. I just liked what they did. And it kind of formed an idea in my head to do that. And that's what I, you know, again, with my obsessive compulsive nature, I just kind of went after it.
Hey, when you say that they're good doctors, what in your mind, like with the experience you have now, in hindsight, what made them good physicians for you?
They were brilliant. In my eyes, they were brilliant. They knew exactly what they were talking about. So they had this force when they walked into a room, which I don't know anymore because I'm one of them. So another doctor walking into a room, coming in with this knowledge about what's going on and what's going to be the treatment strategy is just commonplace for me. But back then there was just this presence in a room when Dr. Travis walked in. I mean, Luther Travis was a big name in diabetes, and they were fortunate to have him at UTMB, and Ben Brohard, likewise, if memory serves, nephrologist. Both of those guys went on to write a book about diabetes not too long after. I have a copy of it in my office. It's in the 80s, I think, so it's relatively old. But you know, the other thing was that they were just very kind, very direct. My mom was very anxious at the time. Of course, her son was diagnosed with diabetes, but I just remember these guys just being very patient and kind of walking her through the process and walking me through the process. And
I'm going to tell you why I'm asking this in a second, but kind, honest, and smart is what I heard overall. And that they had there was a lore about them that they knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when they walk in, you put yourself in their hands because of these ideas, and then they know what they're talking about. So they're able to lead you.
Right.
Okay. So are we talking about leadership? You know what? John, let me tell you why I'm asking, because I know somebody put you on to being on the podcast, so you might not listen to it. I've been doing a series this year. I've been doing two kind of concurrently. One, I'm having healthcare providers on and other people around medicine. So anywhere from like a human resources professional up to I've had CDEs, ER nurses, I've got a doctor on the docket coming up, but these people are coming on and they're speaking anonymously. We're actually even changing their voices, and they're dishing about their jobs. I've heard anywhere from, I wouldn't go to the ER that I work at if I had trouble with my diabetes.
Oh, wow.
To, I've been directed over the last 23 years to fire so many people because of their medical problems, you wouldn't believe it. That kind of honesty, right? And at the same time, I'm doing another series with a CDE. I don't know if you're very particular about the CDECS thing now, but her name is Jenny. And Jenny works for Integrated Diabetes, which is a company where you can, you know, go and they'll manage you remotely and help you. Mm-hmm. She's type 1 for like 35 years. She's a very similar story to yours, like, you know, grew up on regular MPH, was eating on a schedule. She's like, we ate at the exact same time every day, like that kind of stuff. And she's just kind of brilliant about how she talks about diabetes. And she and I are doing a series where we called it Grand Rounds. And we went out to the audience of the podcast, which is significant, and ask them, what do you wish, you know, your doctors would have said to you? What do you wish they would understand? You know, what are you looking for in your interactions? Where did they fall short? And so we're kind of doing this series where we're talking directly to doctors and saying, like, look, this is what people need. And I've just been very involved in it in the last like 3 or 4 months now, hearing from physicians, hearing from medical people that I work with doctors that overwhelmingly don't know what they're talking about when it comes to diabetes, or the healthcare system isn't even set up to help people with diabetes. Like, you'll come into the emergency room and say, like, oh, I'm having an issue with my heart, but then you look at them and they're type 2, for example, and they have, you know, have significant gaps in how they care for themselves, but nobody even explains to them what they're doing wrong. And it's just, and so we're just trying to parse through the whole thing. So I just, to hear a person like yourself who has good control over a lifetime, is an endocrinologist, and thinks back on their doctors as being good, I was really interested, because there's this phenomenon that happens when people come on and I'll say, what do you think of your doctor? And they go, oh, my doctor's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then through the course of the conversation, I learned that their A1C is in the high sevens. It has been for 10 years. And I'll stop and ask them, why do you tell me your doctor's fantastic if your A1C is 7.9? And then they go on to say, oh, well, they're lovely, very nice people. You know, and you tend to realize that the personal part of, they like the person, but the person's not really doing a good job for them. But when they think about it, they think they're doing a good job because they like them. Does that all make sense?
It does. Yeah. It brings up a lot of really sensitive topics, right? I mean, you know, who's responsible for diabetes control in the end, right? Is it your doctor or is it you? Likewise, the workforce today is much different than it was in the 80s. There's a lot of meat on that bone that I think you're gonna pull off a lot of it talking to the right people. I applaud you. That the first one that you described is, you are probably gonna find a lot of interesting information depending upon which hospitals you get people from. And then the second one is fantastic. I think asking people what they wish a doctor would say is information that is not taught in medical schools. And I learned, after I graduated from fellowship, years after, a basic saying that really helps families out, and that's just to look at them in the eye and say, this wasn't your fault. And that's just one little piece of a conversation that probably needs to be a lot longer than it is now. So that's great.
Well, I mean, that's wonderful. I think that what I'm coming up with is that there's some mixture of humanity, communication, and knowledge that the doctor has to have.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes, I'm not trying to be funny, but sometimes what makes you a good doctor does not lead you to be a terrific communicator. And that I'm kind of seeing. But I also,
that's
at the end
true.
Of it.
That's very true, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And at the end of, and that's not to blame anybody, right? Like, it would be like saying, you know, I mean, I'm going to build a building. I want a good engineer. This is not the same guy I would ask to put on a community play. Right.
Okay.
Right. Traditionally, like, that an engineer's mindset and personality might not be, you know, right for other things.
You don't have to be a Renaissance man to be a good doctor.
1,000,000%. Right. But at the same time, when I'm hearing these conversations, I came up with the exact same thing that you said, which is, at what point, if I'm a physician, can I beat my head against that brick wall telling somebody all the good information I have and feeling like they're going to just ignore me anyway? And whose responsibility is it? And I think the answer is, it's everyone's responsibility. If I had to push it to one side, I have to push it a little more towards the doctor, because I'm making an assumption that they at least have a level of intellect that should allow them to get through this problem. I don't know everybody who has diabetes has that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the capacity. That's not their fault. Right. So And at what point, though, does a doctor burn out and just think, I'm not going to say it to this person. It's not going to matter. Like, what happens when they get to that point in their career when, you know what I mean? They start having lower expectations, I guess, and that stops them.
And unfortunately, that's true. And that's not just the doctor's kind of mindset, or it's not always just burnout, but it's the way we kind of metricize or measure satisfaction in clinic. I mean, we can't look at a family who is not doing what we ask them to do, what is standard of care, for example, and tell them, hey, if you don't do what we ask you to do, send us blood sugar logs, take your injections every day, exercise, et cetera, we're going to have to kind of take this to a next level and talk to, you know, CPS or DHS or whoever it is. Yeah. Because satisfaction for both parties really goes down. You have to build this ability. And I know very few doctors who can do this. And I wish they would give some sort of masterclass on it, because I am not one of these doctors. But there are doctors out there who can have conversations that are very direct and kind, but forceful.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, come in from that. That's the one thing you were describing about your doctors that I didn't want to put a label on at first, but they cast a big shadow. Like, they're smart and bright, and we know that they do a good job. So that when they come in the room, you kind of step back a little bit and go, "Oh, there's the guy." Like, I heard stories. You know what I mean?
There's the guy that's going to tell me how to take care of myself, and I want to be in good control.
Yeah, and I believe I
want to be able to be healthy.
What happens? Here's the thing that happens constantly. So I'm in a weird position, John, where I have no medical training at all. I have a daughter who has type 1 diabetes. She was diagnosed when she was 2. I was a stay-at-home dad. She's 19 now. Mm. I started writing a blog about it the year after she was diagnosed, but in honesty, was just trying to raise money for JDRF.
Right.
And then I was bad at diabetes, like genuinely. And my daughter's A1C was in the 8s or the 9s, but she went to a very, very good, what you would consider a very good children's hospital for endocrinology. Sure. But it didn't matter, right? Like, they'd tell me what to do. I'd go home and do it. It didn't matter. I just didn't have enough knowledge. I didn't have enough tools. And I build them up along the way, as, you know, is a very common story. But because I was writing this blog, I started to, like, share what was working for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started seeing it helping other people.
Right.
And I was like, oh, wow, my experience transferred to you. You end up having the same outcome I have. That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did that for years, 2007 up to 2015. And it was a really, I'm just saying this for context, but it was a very popular blog. Like, it had millions and millions of clicks.
Mm.
And then one day, blogging got passe. I guess people stopped reading.
Right, yeah.
And I pivoted to a podcast in 2015, January. And it was the first diabetes podcast that existed.
Mm.
And I started sharing more, like, this is what we do, this is how I feel, and blah, blah, blah. And now, John, like, the podcast has a collective total of 16 million downloads.
Lord.
It's in the top 100 chart of, like, 48 different countries. And I have a private Facebook group with 46,000 people in it. They're almost all active. And if you go in there and just, if you were to go in there right now and say, "Hey, my name's John, I'm an endocrinologist. Tell me what about this podcast helps you." You will probably get responses back for the next 5 days. And so the things that I figured out about diabetes are transferable. And I'm able to share them without knowing you. So without knowing who you are or knowing any of your details, because it's a one-way communication medium, I'm getting people back like, my A1C came down 3 points. I'm in the 7s now steady. I'm in the 6s. I'm in the 5s. I know how to use this. I'm very comfortable. Like, all this stuff happens. When I look back, I keep thinking, like, why can't a doctor do that for people? Like, why? They come to me because they have no satisfaction through their healthcare. Like, if they didn't, there'd be no reason to go look for help, right? They'd be okay.
Yeah.
And the only thing I can come up with is it's the frequency. That we can keep connecting, that you can have bigger conversations and you can pick ideas out little bits at a time. Anyway, my thought is, and I say this whenever I can, I think endocrinologists should go to, like, group appointments. And so instead of someone coming in for 15 minutes, you should come in and sit in a room for a couple of hours where different physicians will come in and speak to their ideas and take questions so that other people can hear other people's concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And go back and forth. I think it's the only way for that model to, like, help people in mass. And I don't know what you think about that. I was wondering, like, I know they, like, taking out HIPAA things and, you know, billing all the problems that would get in the way of that. Do you think that would work, though?
I mean, you're talking about kind of mass education on a kind of more frequent level, right? I mean,
yeah.
No, I think that would work if you did take away issues with billing, issues with productivity measures for physicians, because, hey, we've got, you know, X number of physicians in the state, and they have to see one in every 600 kids 3 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of process that you're describing, although, check, yes, I think that would do a lot for kids, would take a kind of Herculean effort to pull off. But I will add a little bit of a variable in your calculus for
please
how things kind of move at least in my opinion. And part of that is transference of blame in some of these patients' eyes. I've had families that, you know, they, after years of seeing me and getting to know me and building a pretty good rapport, I have to say, I love all the kids that I see. I look forward to seeing them. I think they're wonderful. I think their families are all wonderful. It all ways, shapes, and forms, all forms of control. I feel for them. I empathize with them. But a few of them have come to me and said, you know, when we were first diagnosed, I blamed you for the diagnosis because you were in the room when it happened. And I think that that baggage carries a lot of restrictive emotional absorption, yeah. if that makes sense. Meaning, you know, I can tell them all I want to tell them. I can have a 50-minute long conversation about pathophysiology and treatment and prognosis. And hey, kids with diabetes do great if they have good control. But in that mindset, for however long it lasts, because it doesn't last forever, I don't think, mm-hmm. in many families. I think they come to terms with it after a while. But I think the absorption of information with that mindset of I am in a medical community with a physician that told me my child had diabetes and X percentage of them hold that physician responsible.
Yeah. I had this experience when my son was younger, like very small. He had a blockage in his ear, like a wax buildup. And I took him to the pediatrician who I happen to know. And he sent a nurse in with like a lavage kit. And then he left the room very specifically. And he came back and I asked him afterwards, like privately, I was like, why did you run out? And he goes, I don't want him correlating his experience with me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, no kidding. He goes, yeah, let him hate the nurse. And I was like, oh, okay.
We have families that, you know, they'll come in with their kids and, you know, they'll say, just trying to be funny, mom and dad will say something like, if you don't behave, doctor's going to give you a shot. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to give them a shot. Please don't tell them.
Don't make me the bad guy. Right. Yeah. Like, but that is what, so, you know, here's the little, like, not so dirty secret about the Grand Round series that I'm making is as much as we are talking at doctors, I'm also, that's not the only people who are going to be listening. So I'm trying to simultaneously say to a physician, here's what people expect from you. But I'm trying to say to the patients, you know, here's who people are. Like, they're doctors. They're just people. And, you know, here's some of the problems that they have and, you know, some of their hurdles. You have to understand that everybody's got to meet halfway. And you maybe you're the problem and you think it's the doctor. Or sometimes, you know, John, I will have people listen to, I have a series called Diabetes Pro Tip. It's like 25 episodes. I guarantee you, if you listen to it, your A1C will be in the low sixes. If you even reasonably understand what you listen to, if you really understand it, you'll get a high five. I hand it whatever you pray to. So, but I'll have people tell me, I listened to the Pro Tip series. I got my A1C down. My variability is better. Fewer lows, this whole thing. I go to the doctor and the doctor says, there's no way you got this A1C without a bunch of lows. And then and then people are like, no, I didn't. But listen to the chain of events then, John. Then they go, no, I listened to a podcast. And then the doctor's probably like, oh, okay. And you know what I mean? Right. So it gets dismissive. And they will tell them, bring your A1C up. This is dangerous because they believe so specifically that they must be having a low. So there are physicians out there in mass who don't even think that a low six is achievable. And if you have one, you're offsetting high blood sugars with very low blood sugars.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've met those guys and we had, Dallas? I think we had one of our fellows had a conversation with a doctor out in the boonies somewhere who didn't believe the DCCT. And so his goal for the patients he was seeing was not improvement in A1C. So I absolutely believe you that there are people out there that say you can safely achieve those kind of numbers, despite improvements in technology.
Significant.
Yeah.
Here's some other things that happen all the time. I had a low at, I don't know, 2 a.m. or 1 a.m, right? And the doctor will take and go, oh, well, then turn your basal down at like, you know, midnight. Mm-hmm. They never ask them what they had for dinner, what they ate, what the bolus was 3 or 4 hours before. Then they make this deficit in basal. which then, of course, creates a high later in the morning. And then the next time you come back, you're like, hey, I'm getting high at 5 a.m. And they keep messing with it, but they don't seem to understand how insulin works.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that thing you figured out when you were a kid, like you looked and said, these amount of carbs needs more insulin. I can tell. And but it happens so frequently that I'm going to tell you that the whole basis of the ProTip series is just, it's timing and amount. It's understanding how insulin works and that's it. Like, that's the whole thing. Like if you made me stand up in front of a world full of people using insulin and said, Scott, you have 30 seconds to fix these people's lives, I'd say it's timing and amount. It's using the right amount of insulin at the right time. I don't have time to give you the rest of the details, but that's the entirety of it right there. Go figure that out.
Yeah.
You know, but then
you're absolutely right.
Listen, it's also not brain surgery, John. I was just the first one willing to say it out loud and have my voice recorded that was in this kind of medium. If you listen to other diabetes content, they will always artfully speak around giving what they think might be medical advice. I'm not giving medical advice. I'm telling people what I do. They can do whatever they want. And I have a good disclaimer. It's rock solid, John, so don't worry about it. I just think it's wrong to know this stuff about managing diabetes and not share it with people. But I'm fascinated and dumbfounded by a physician who can't figure out how to adjust a situation for a low blood sugar. Like, how would you not? That my first question would be, what did you eat for dinner? Does it have fat in it? Did it have protein in it? Did you, what did you eat today? How was your activity? Like, just turn your basal down randomly at midnight for one low you saw at 1 a.m. Like, that stuff, that's baffling.
Well, I think what you'll find as partly an answer is that the medical community now is struggling. You have primary care physicians who really aren't trained in diabetes, but are in some ways forced to see patients with diabetes because the volume of endocrinologists they're dwindling. Mm. There's not that many of us left in this world. And there's many reasons for that that would take hours to discuss. But I understand your argument, and I think you're right. It's baffling to think about, but realize that some of these guys and gals are having to see, 30 kids in an afternoon, and one of them happens to be a person with diabetes, and, hey, I have a low in the middle of the night, and they're going to be first thing off the top of their head. The easiest answer is going to be exactly what you described.
Yeah.
And the answer to make all of that better, apart from improving education, which I wholeheartedly support and work towards. In fact, we're wanting to do kind of a endocrinology for pediatrics conference in Arkansas, which we're kind of crossing our fingers we get funding for. But the other issue would be to explore a way to make sure that either primary care physicians are trained in diabetes, or we bolster the number of endocrinologists that are being trained, which both of which are going to are massive undertakings.
Would it maybe not be pertinent to create a new specialty? Like, why do we ask endocrinologists to know about like this wide range and diabetes? Like, there's enough people with diabetes in the world now. Like, couldn't a specific diabetes endocrinologist be like a lucrative like career for someone?
Well, there has been discussions about changing the fellowship from a 3-year to a 2-year program. And that would be kind of a motion towards that. But think about it this way. We graduated maybe 50 or 60 fellows every year for the past couple of years. There are hundreds and hundreds of open positions and more opening every month around the country, around the world.
Yeah.
Trying to, kind of find that needle in a haystack person like me or some of my colleagues that want to do specifically diabetes, which is a chronic disease that is difficult to manage and has social barriers to it, mm-hmm. financial barriers to it, it would be hard without, I don't mean to say financially incentivizing, but some sort of kind of,
it's a hard job.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I guess, John, where I get tripped up is some like 30 years ago, I graduated from high school at the bottom of my class and went to a job at a sheet metal shop the next morning. And if you ask the right person, you'd want to come to me to learn about diabetes. So I always feel like if I can do it, like anybody could. Like I know my listen, I understand that my communication style works for a lot of people. I'm sure there are plenty of people who it doesn't work for too. That's not the case, you know, not up to for debate as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure there are plenty of people that hate me, but like, I know how to talk to people about diabetes. I know how to explain it in a very kind of easily digestible way. And I think that if I can do it, like, Jesus, a doctor could do it. And
you've been doing it for 16 years.
I'm also have a ton of practice at it. And that is the thing that, yeah. See, I appreciate you saying that, because that's even something that I would lose sight of, because I wrote that blog with no, like, it didn't make money. I wasn't trying to make money with it. My entire focus was to share a personal thing with you, John, is I wrote that blog thinking, if I educate enough people about what this is, then one day, if my daughter's out in the world and she falls over in public, maybe somebody will understand what's happening to her. Like, mm-hmm. That's what I used to think when she was 2 years old. And it stemmed from just a newspaper article about a guy that got kicked off the train on the Northeast Corridor, I think between New York and Washington somewhere. He was on a train. He was drunk. They kicked him off at a stop. 6 o'clock in the morning when the commuters were coming in, he's laying literally in a stone driveway. And everybody's walking past him and mocking him for being drunk. But this one person who grew up with a sibling with type 1 diabetes recognized what was happening with him and stopped and saved the guy. Right? Because he really had a low blood sugar. And yeah. I used to think, maybe odd, like crazily, I used to think if I could reach enough people and tell them about diabetes, if my daughter falls over like that, somebody might help her one day. And that's a really Pollyanna idea that I had in the beginning, obviously. But I also wasn't trying to make money at it. And I was able to have experiences and build on them. And I had feedback coming in from people who were reading. So I knew what worked and what didn't work. I could write something and see, like, oh, it doesn't work to speak to people in this tone. It doesn't work to be too specific, too technical. You need to be more, you know, it needs to be easier to digest. I had a lot of time to develop this.
You should do I don't know if masterclass is anything, but you should do a masterclass on educating people with diabetes.
John, twice a year, a hospital will contact me and ask me to come out and speak to the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually it gets up the ladder far enough at the hospital. Somebody puts the kibosh on it. It never happens.
Yeah. Well, because
I'm not a doctor. Yeah. Yeah.
Really? Okay.
But I'll tell you this, John, I did a talk in Austin this year or just recently, mm-hmm. a couple months ago. JDRF said, you know, we do these little like coffee talks. Like, would you fly down here and talk to, like, there's like 40 people in our, thing. And I was like, if I come down there, it's not going to be 40 people. I was like, we sold, I think every ticket they could for the space they found, like 350 people showed up. We had to hold it in the Texas State Capitol, which is really cool. She says, so, you know, how long do you want this to be? An hour and a half? And I was like, no, all day.
Oh, wow.
And she goes, people won't sit. I was like, they'll sit. And so we settled finally on 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. So we came in, we did a 2 hour, Jenny came with me. We did this 2 hour just kind of like chat. It didn't have, like, I promise you that Jenny and I talked to each other before we went on stage and said, what do you think we should talk about? Mm-hmm. And then we went up there, started, we talked for 2 hours. They went to lunch. They came back at 1 o'clock. We did Q&A for 3 hours. Nobody left. And that evening, I got an email from a woman that said, hey, you know, we did a lot of traveling after we left there. My daughter's blood sugars normally would have been troublesome in a car, you know, crappy food mm-hmm. on the highway, that kind of stuff. And she said, but they weren't. They were very stable and where we wanted them to be. But I don't know why. And I was like, yeah, you know why, because we sat around and we talked about these little like micro ideas about how to manage and, you know, let's pre-bolus and, you know, let's, you know, if you see mm-hmm. a high blood sugar, let's knock it back down again. Don't look at it. Like, I promise you, there was no slideshow. I didn't give any bulleted points. We just had a conversation and then she mm-hmm. left and had a better outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I know how to do that. That's maybe the only thing in the world I'm good at, John. I take your point that I don't know how a doctor would be expected to accomplish that.
Well, I think it goes back to my idea that, you know, in some ways, a doctor is kind of looked at in a certain way, and then an educator is looked at it a different way. And I don't know if there's ever a mix between the two where you can kind of separate it. So Dr. Oden is going to give a lecture on how to manage your blood sugars. And it would come off as, you know, kind of trite and scientific. Whereas a person like you with a vast amount of experience now and knowledge can give just basic tips and comfortable tips on how to do things in the real world. And that's, I think that's a huge bonus for our community. I mean, I think that's great that you do that.
The success of the podcast tells me that it works, right? Because, you know, it doesn't matter if you have a little kid or a teenager or you're an adult. Like, I get as many notes from people who are like, I've had diabetes for 25 years. Why did nobody ever tell me this? You know, as I do from newly diagnosed people. I think it just works, you know, and this interesting thing that I've been toying with lately, it's not nowhere near ready for prime time, but we now have so many conversations that the way AI works is I've been loading the more management heavy conversations into AI and learning. Oh, yeah. You can ask it almost anything about diabetes and it knows the answer.
Does it really? I mean, so you created that, or is that just something that's AI?
I'm using a service. I'm uploading literally the audio from my episodes, and like down to like we have episodes about like how to set your basal insulin, like the math of your basal insulin, right? Mm-hmm. And it's never late. It's just a conversation where we mention the math here and there and everything. But you can ask. You can have AI ask that audio, basically that transcript. I weigh this much. I'm a reasonably active adult. Where should I start with my basal insulin? And it brings back the right range. It's
creepy and cool at the same time.
Yeah. So my goal is, I'm nowhere near done making the podcast, but my goal is the last thing I'd like to leave for people with diabetes is a website where they can just go ask it questions about diabetes.
Yeah.
That's my end goal for when I'm finished. But for right now, the job is very repetitive, like because 150 new people come into my Facebook group every 3.5 to 4 days. And so, you know, you're always kind of saying, you know, you're pointing them to the right episodes to get their answers from. And that's also great too, because they can learn on their own time. They don't have to sit in front of a physician and feel like judged or like dumb, which I felt that way sitting in front of doctors before. So yeah, there's a lot about why it works.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
I think the truth is, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I said, well, every once in a while, you'll run into somebody who's like pissed that, like, I don't have diabetes, if that makes sense. I don't know if that would bother you or not. And I always tell them the same thing. Like, I think I'm able to be like kind of dispassionate about it. Like, I don't have it, right? Like, when my daughter was getting low, I didn't feel low. I just saw a problem that needed to be handled. And so the way I would come up on fixing that problem might be different than the way you would think too if your blood sugar was 50.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And I was motivated by I want to give my daughter a long life. Like, to be candid, like, I want to die before my kids. Like, that's really like what most of my focus is. You know what I mean? I don't want to be a 70-year-old guy looking at my daughter and she's sick.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I would tell you, you do have a form of diabetes, my friend. Family members who have, you know, my wife has been with me for, you know, 34 years and, yeah. She has a form of diabetes. Yes, she does. She doesn't have to take insulin, but she does have to worry about blood sugars and exercise and routine and pump site changes. And yeah, she has to do that.
Yeah. Oh no, I don't discount it. And I appreciate that. I just once in a while online, I'll get from people who are like, I don't, you know, one person said recently how much it bothers them that the most popular diabetes podcast in the world is run by a person who doesn't have diabetes.
No, I don't subscribe to that. I think anybody who has a family member that they love and care for with diabetes has a form of diabetes. It's not necessarily affecting their metabolism, but it's certainly affecting their lives.
Yeah, it's a very thoughtful way to consider it. I appreciate that. So I think I want to make sure I heard right from you that there's a system set up, and you said Herculean at one point. Like, to get anything really changed is probably unrealistic. So what are we waiting for people with diabetes? Are we waiting for, I mean, eventually is like going to a doctor going to be online? Is it going to be, are you going to go to a portal and tell it what's wrong and it's going to give you like 5 ideas of what it might be and then put you on a call with a doctor and they'll chat through with you? Like, do you think it's all going to move in that direction?
I certainly hope not. I think there is a proximity and physicality to being a doctor. I've done telemedicine before, and I think it has its place. Not a huge fan of the experience for my patients or for me as a physician. I like to see people and kind of have a really good conversation before I make any decisions or recommendations, I guess I should say. So I think in some futuristic view of medicine, there is going to have to be somewhat of a change. I think the pendulum changes, though, from time to time. So now we're more focused on primary care because there's not enough primary care out there. And as our numbers dwindle, there's going to be a more focus on subspecialties like endocrinology, pediatric endocrinology, which is what I do.
Yeah.
But in the end, we are going to have to rely a lot on technology and AI, as you mentioned, and you know all the things that we can bring to focus to make sure that our kids are safe and happy, live long lives, and are healthy.
John, are there fewer doctors or more people?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think both is very true. I mean, okay. I can tell you there are fewer and fewer endocrinologists in the past four or five years or so. I know five or six of my close colleagues that have either retired or quit or passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you the people that mentored me when I was coming up in endocrinology, most of them, if not all of them, have retired or passed away. Well, there was a couple of guys in San Francisco that I just idolized. And there was one in North Carolina that I idolized. And they are, two of them are gone. And one of them has retired. And the other one retired. So it's...
Are fewer people becoming doctors?
You know, I don't know that. I can't answer that okay. intelligently.
Yeah.
I get a sense that we are struggling to fill seats in medical schools. But I can tell you with almost certainty that we are struggling to fill positions in fellowships. And that is going to affect the way that diabetes and other subspecialties approach their patients.
Yeah, I just applications to medical school in 2022-23 numbered 55,188, 11.6% fewer than in 2021-2022, but 4% more than in 2020 to 2021. That could be COVID though, right?
Mm-hmm.
A total of 22,712 students enrolled in medical school in 2022-23, about the same as in 2021-22. Listen, my wife wanted to be a physician coming out of college, and she had like financial trouble, which just didn't allow her to make a lot of applications.
Oh, yeah. Good Lord, it was expensive.
Really expensive. She had good MCATs, like a great undergrad. Like she would have been a good doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And as she was lamenting that in the first couple of years where she was working in industry, a friend of ours who's a physician said, you know, listen, you're probably going to do better than I do, and you're not going to have to pay all these like insurance problems and like all this other stuff. He's like, don't worry about it. Like he actually was telling her like, don't be a doctor. That's doctors telling people don't be doctors
mm-hmm.
because of the headaches that come along with it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the bigger picture is once you get somebody to be a doctor, they are who they are and they may or may not be great communicators. I know everybody thinks smart, right? But not every doctor is brilliant. Like, you know, so you're looking for kind, honest, smart, you know, can be able to communicate. If you're lucky enough to get those things, what if you're then the impediment as the patient? What if you're not, you know, paying attention, motivated, et cetera? There's a lot of different tripping points through the process.
To that point, every doctor has a bad day. Every doctor has multiple bad days.
Such a good point. Yeah.
You know, you're on call the week before, it's Monday, you've got a full clinic and you're just tired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you don't put your best foot forward. And you know,
yeah.
With the way that we're measuring satisfaction and the way we're measuring productivity, it weighs on you. All the reports that we get, all the nudges that we get from people that are above us, it does. It weighs on you. It's a stress. And it does, as you mentioned before, it contributes to burnout.
Yeah. I use a boutique endo for my daughter. And, you know, we're lucky our insurance covers it after the fact really well. But I have the ability to text or email a doctor and she still has trouble keeping up. And she has a limited, you know, practice. She doesn't take everybody. Actually, I don't think she's taken new patients in years. And still, it's hard. As much of a personal relationship as I feel like we have with her, I still recognize that every time we see her or speak to her, the first 5 minutes is you reminding her who you are. and what your situation is, because there's no way for her to keep all that in her head. Like, she'll be like, oh, I remember, or that kind of stuff. But I actually think that's a problem. People, like, I see one doctor, the doctor sees hundreds of patients. Mm-hmm. But when I go to see them, I feel like I'm having such a personal interaction that I just expect that they remember everything that's been said between us. And that's not nearly the case either. In the end, a lot of these conversations, whether they're the cold wind, which is what I'm calling the anonymous conversations, or these grand rounds or anything, at the end, what I come down to is like this whole it's a human limitation issue on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not a thing you're going to fix or change.
No.
Yeah.
Not completely, and not in the short term, no.
Right. So the answer is what you hear people say all the time. You have to advocate for yourself and take your care into your own hands to some degree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
That's pretty much it, right?
Yeah.
Well, I guess we keep saying that out loud long enough, people will listen. But, you know, I don't know. I can't reach everybody, John. I'm trying.
Well, I think you're doing a good job. I think the podcast, my educators, some of my educators listen to it and they really enjoy it and they get something out of it. So that's, I appreciate that.
No, I'm glad. And thank you for saying so. I really, that is my underlying goal. You know, day to day, I want to help people living with diabetes. Yeah. But long term, I just want to impact enough people who will end up in medicine that maybe they'll say, hey, you got low at 1 o'clock. What'd you have for dinner? That's all. That's my hope.
You got it a little bit.
I'm just looking for little advancements on that. I'll ask you one last question. I'll let you go. I know we're up on time. Why do we not talk about the impacts of fat, protein, and general food quality with type 1s?
Oh, good Lord. I'm not going to blow my own horn because I certainly don't emphasize this in clinic and in any force at all, but I've always been an advocate for a healthy diet. You know, I grew up on the exchange diet, which was in some way a healthier diet than kind of a meal ratio diet, which allows kids to eat whatever, whenever. But it's because of the kind of westernized diet that we have that kind of brings that down, the ratio down, because kids don't have access to really good healthy food. I think the other answer is that the metabolism of protein and fat, although defined in some scientific reports, is difficult in pediatrics because of their variability in metabolism. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to build out a structured education component to, you know, say, for example, a 14-year-old football player versus an 8-year-old gymnast versus a 12-year-old who likes to play video games. I mean, how do you build that kind of one size fits all education?
I can tell you how I did it. Say, if you see a rise 60 to 90 to 120 minutes after you've eaten, that's another impact that's coming from slower digestion. You should probably bolus for it. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. I think that's one way. I was thinking more along the lines of, hey, if I'm going to have a steak and potato or pizza or spaghetti and meat sauce, how do I dose for that?
Yeah.
And that's challenging.
You don't want to set somebody up with an extended bolus, for example, if their activity will burn through that later push.
And then again, too, some families are set up to where they can process that information relatively simply. And then there are other families that, you know, mom and dad work 3 jobs and, you know, sister's helping out in the evening. And, you know, it's hard to kind of get them on board with that kind of math.
Yeah. Yeah. I do see the bigger problem. I really do. I just,
yeah.
But once they ask the question, why don't they get the answer then? Like, once they show the propensity for like, hey, I don't understand what's happening here. Like, you can't just tell them fat slows down digestion. And because of that, your insulin might wane while there's still food being, you know, carbs being leached into your system as blood sugar. Like, is that not difficult?
No. That's not. When the question does arise, I think, at least, I mean, I approach it that way.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, the question doesn't arise very often.
What I tell people all the time is that maybe the phrase I hear the most that I hate the most is, oh, that's just diabetes.
Oh, whoops.
Yeah, which gives away the idea that there could be an impact here that we could understand and do something about.
No, I think, and then, yeah, it's one of those things that I think if you had that hour-long, 2-hour-long education piece with a very few number of families, and you looked at their downloads and you could see their, you know, the waves of their blood sugars and insulin boluses, you could probably say, okay, on Friday at 6 o'clock, what'd you eat? And they would say, oh, we went to, you know, Buster's Steakhouse. And you would say, oh, so this is probably fat and protein. We need to do it this way. This is how we would do it. But that doesn't happen in real life.
So do you have a minute for another question?
Sure.
Oh, great. So for people who are never going to get it, do we just want them to be on like an islet pump, for example?
Oh, wow. Good question. I think there is space for an islet pump in its current programming for such statement. Yeah.
Yeah. Just say, look, you got an 8A1C. There's nothing. And by the way, I'm being polite, right? Yeah. Like the people who don't get it, don't get it to the tune of like 9, 10, 11 A1Cs, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you say to them, look, you put this on, small meal, it's breakfast, you're going to get a 7A1C. Is that a win? And because they were never going to get it anyway? That makes sense.
I think if you look at it from the lens of an A1C as being your target metric, then yes, check. And the DCCT did show that. I was in a conference a couple of years back where one of my colleagues said something that has just stuck with me. And she was commenting on how some algorithms, you know, shut down insulin delivery for X number of hours.
Yeah.
And she said, well, we don't know what happens to your body when it doesn't have any insulin at all in it, alluding to the fact that it could kind of be producing in some small way, you know, metabolites that aren't healthy for you.
Interesting.
And so I think before we answer that question as to whether or not that pump would be, quote unquote, good in the long run, we need to know exactly what it's doing to their metabolism. Yeah, and I think that's not going to come out in the near future. That's going to come out over the course of the next 5 to 10 years.
It's interesting. I watched a lot of different algorithms work a lot of different ways. My daughter at the moment is wearing IAPS, which is a DIY algorithm.
Yeah.
It kind of manages backwards. Like it front loads with insulin and then takes away basal until it needs to come back again. But you're not really without insulin because you have a pretty large bolus going.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that person talking about like, when basal gets cut away for a very long time to try to save a low.
And what is a very long time? Is it 5 minutes? Is it 30 minutes? Is it an hour? Is it 2 hours?
It varies. Know. Yeah. The situation's going to keep it. Cause if everything's settings, like in algorithms, it's all about your settings. So it's your settings and you timing your meal boluses. It's pretty much where you're going to get success from. But now it's an interesting idea. I just think that if someone's going to have that unhealthy of a lifestyle to begin with, and time has proven that for whatever reason they aren't changing that, if you could at least put this thing on them that would keep them at a seven, I mean, that's got to be a net positive. Like I get that you can't say that it for sure would be, but it feels like it would be.
It feels like it would be to me as well.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with you. And I think in some ways you have to say that it's a win because, you know, their A1Cs are better and their blood sugars are better and their triglycerides are probably better. So metabolism has probably moved to a space that it's better, but is better good enough?
Right. Oh, no. Yeah. And I don't think it is. But I guess my question is what if that's a person who was, you just weren't going to reach? Do you know what I mean? Like, it almost feels like, I can't believe I'm saying this. It feels like a clean needle program for diabetes. Like I'm not going to get you to stop using heroin, but I could at least give you a clean needle.
But, yeah. No, I mean, that's an interesting analogy, but I think for now we can say that it would be a good pump, a good platform to recommend. Mm-hmm. We can have some baseline assumptions on what it's going to do with some kind of joy in our heart that it's going to do better. But again, do we know that it's the best step forward?
Okay. My last question about algorithms are, after seeing people who are paying attention, learned, understand their diabetes, go to an algorithm. Do they get dumb about diabetes? Do they forget things or does that not happen?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But that was a concern at the beginning that people had. Like if we keep slapping these algorithms on people, they won't know how to take care of their diabetes. But I don't think that's the case.
I don't think so. I honestly, I have noted the opposite. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, many of these families, and they come from all different backgrounds. I don't want to say that, you know, there is a certain socioeconomic norm to those groups, but there are people out there who absorb this stuff. And when they get on an algorithm, they understand a little bit better and they apply it a little bit better and they understand it and they're able to do things independently. And they come to see me and they're like, oh, hey, Dr. Oden, we're doing great. We just changed his, you know, his sensitivity the other day, and he's doing great. We don't really need you. Thank you very much. And then they're out the door.
I learned more about watching Loop work through like Night Scout. Like I was already, but when my daughter started looping a number of years ago now, I was really good at diabetes. Like I had her A1C in the fives. It was no trouble. I was basically an algorithm already. We were, you know, temp basaling, taking insulin away, giving extra, that kind of stuff. But watching it do it automatedly, I think upped my game. And so I agree with you. I know I keep saying one last thing, but I want to share something with you and get your top line reaction from it. So my daughter is 19 and uses basal 1.1 an hour. Her insulin sensitivity 1 to 42. Her carb ratio was like 1 to 4.5, like pretty strong stuff, right? But she also has what we thought maybe like some PCOS symptoms.
Okay.
So her physician put her on the lowest dose of Ozempic that's allowable, 0.25 is as low as you can inject, right? She has not moved up, and she's been doing this for 2.5 months now.
Mm-hmm.
She lost 10 pounds that honestly I didn't think she had to lose, but after she lost it, you go, okay, that's fair. But that's not the point about the weight part. Her basal went from 1.1 an hour to 0.7 an hour. Her insulin sensitivity went from 1 to 42 to 1 to 63. And her insulin to carb, I think now is like 1 to 7.5 or 8. And I'm calculating that she'll use more than 12,000 fewer units of insulin next year.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
that's great.
I have an interview coming out soon with the mother of like a 13-year-old girl, has had type 1 diabetes for over 3 years. I think was using 70 units of insulin a day on average, and she's down to between 4 and 7 units of injected basal. She took her pump off and doesn't have to bolus for food anymore. And she's using Wegovy for weight loss.
Yeah.
Are you seeing that?
Well, no, because we can't get those medications approved.
Yeah. They're cash pay stuff for sure.
Yeah.
Well, not for this one little girl, because she got it approved for weight loss, and then she just happened to have type 1 and got all these other benefits from it.
Yeah, every state and every insurance company is different, is what we're finding, and we fight the good fight for a little bit, and we've just been kind of pushed back for the majority. We're advocating for the GLP-1s to be covered, but we haven't quite made that a success story yet. Yeah,
I think we get there in the next couple of years on that.
Knock on wood, that would be great.
But I mean, how fascinating is that? That my daughter's needs changed. By the way, they would call 0.25 of Ozempic a non-therapeutic dose.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
At least it will.
It's insane what it did for her.
Well, I've had, like, you know, I said, I was a runner, and you know, I go on kicks of not running for very long, and my insulin sensitivity goes down and my requirements go up, and then I start running again, and you know, I drop, you know, 10, 15 pounds and, you know, it comes right back. And it speaks volumes for healthy appetite. I mean, healthy meals and good exercise every day, which is what we try to instill in all of our kids.
Oh, for sure. And I agree with that. But I need to tell you that my daughter's insulin adjustments came before the weight loss. Like literally within the first 4 days, we had to start taking her insulin away. She was getting low, like right away. It was insane.
Yeah.
I keep wondering out loud if we're going to learn that people have some sort of a GLP deficiency at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because I will tell you that I the only reason I knew about it to talk to the doctor about my daughter is that I used Wegovy for weight loss. And in a year, less than a year, I've lost 45 pounds. But wow. I haven't really changed anything about my lifestyle. So it's I lost 4 pounds in the first 5 days after shooting it, I don't know. Like I can't, I'm trying to stay alive long enough to hear how this ends, John, because I'm very interested by it.
These medications are going to be critical in the management of type 2. And, you know, there may be a space in there for certain patients with type 1.
Yeah, so it's possible. It's not going to be for everybody. I know that. Like, I also see, I don't know if you're hearing from people or not, but the Mounjaro or the Zepbound, like that seems to have fewer kind of impacts on people's I don't know, bowel habits, I guess, and stuff like that, like kind of like indigestion stuff. But but it's just very interesting. It's all in its infancy. It's incredibly interesting. I'm excited for people to stop talking about it. Like, oh, that's what famous people do to be thin. I'm like, there's a lot of application here. So I can't wait to see it. All right, man. I can't thank you enough for doing this. Was this what you expected? I hope.
Yeah. Yeah. This was great. This was a lot of fun. Thank you very much for accepting my request.
Oh, are you kidding? Yeah, no, stuff. Some pretty cool people said you were good. So I was like, all right.
Oh, good Lord.
So I was like, all right, I definitely would love to do this. Thank you. Hold on 1 second for me. A huge thank you to one of today's sponsors, Gvoke Glucagon. Find out more about Gvoke HypoPen at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. You spell that GVOKEGLUCAGON.com/juicebox. Having an easy to use and accurate blood glucose meter is just one click away. ContourNext.com/juicebox. That's right. Today's episode is sponsored by the Contour Next Gen Blood Glucose Meter. I want to thank the Eversense CGM for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast and invite you to go to eversensecgm.com/juicebox to learn more about this terrific device. You can head over now and just absorb everything that the website has to offer, and that way you'll know if Eversense feels right for you. eversensecgm.com/juicebox. If you or a loved one was just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and you're looking for some fresh perspective, the Bold Beginnings series from the Juice Box Podcast is a terrific place to start. That series is with myself and Jenny Smith. Jenny is a CDCES, a registered dietitian, and a type 1 for over 35 years. And in the Bold Beginnings series, Jenny and I are going to answer the questions that most people have after a type 1 diabetes diagnosis. The series begins at episode 698 in your podcast player, or you can go to juiceboxpodcast.com and click on Bold Beginnings in the menu. If you're looking for community around type 1 diabetes, check out the Juice Box Podcast private Facebook group, Juice Box Podcast, Type 1 Diabetes. But everybody is welcome. Type 1, type 2, gestational, loved ones, it doesn't matter to me. If you're impacted by diabetes and you're looking for support, comfort, or community, check out Juice Box Podcast, Type 1 Diabetes on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Juice Box Podcast. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording. WrongWayRecording.com.